And then they do this thing where he asks for prayers from the congregants. There was this older woman, and she turns around and talks to everyone and says, "My son has leukemia. The first time it got really bad, the doctors step in, they saved his life. I don't trust the doctors anymore, and his leukemia is getting really bad again, and I just want to know if God will cure my son or not." He puts his hand on her shoulder, kind of looks out to all of us, and he said, "Don't you worry about anything. You don't need those doctors. God will help your son." And I'm looking around. I'm looking left. I'm looking right. And most people are really into it. And I feel like I'm the loneliest person in the world going, like, that could kill him.
It starts with just taking that leap.
Man, you have to work hard. You have to be incredibly smart.
Choose something that even if it fails, you are going to be proud of it.
Doesn't matter how badly you got beaten down.
Be kind, be kind, be kind.
Become a better person, a better leader, the better business.
Go with your gut.
I'm Samuel Donner, and this is Finding Founders.
That was intense. That kind of reinvigorated me to think about my work.
This realization that religion could prevent its followers from getting life-saving medical attention, that was something that shocked Evan. And this was yet another reason that he felt drawn to atheism, a word that he first discovered in a dictionary years before. Later, Evan would attend California Lutheran College, which inspired him to create the Secular Student Alliance. Through this, he was able to create a community for students like himself who did not feel connected to religion. Springboarding out of college, he eventually settled in Los Angeles, where he continued creating community for atheists through his role as the executive director of Atheists United. But let's go way back to life before all of this, a life that started in a conservative Catholic school.
Can you maybe tell me some of your earliest memories growing up, specifically maybe like earliest memories around religion, institutionalized religion, the religion that you were brought up in?
I have a vague concept of my parents talking about religion when I was young, my mom maybe suggesting we should go to church or taking us, and my father not really having language for it. But I think it all started in first grade. We moved to this small rural central Massachusetts town, and my parents were looking for a place to put me. They had enough money to put me in a private school, and they put me in this Catholic Latin mass every morning, kind of conservative Catholic school.
Latin mass is intense. Yeah.
And I'm, you know, it's hard to even put my mind back into a first grader's body, but you're talking about every morning having to get into a suit. Like, I have to put on a tie, a little clip-on tie, right? Click that on. I have to put on a jacket that I hate. I'm a wiggly little child. And then the first thing you have to do before school even starts is sit through this Latin mass. And we're talking about the guy walking down the aisle with all the kind of like smells, and you got to like kneel before you get into the pews, and you have no idea what's happening. You just have this guy mumbling another language for almost an hour, and the older kids seemingly really into it. They know all the rituals, and you're brand new to all of this, looking around going, what on earth is everyone doing, and why do I have to do it? So I think my first questioning of religion probably started there. I remember when I started to complain to my parents about religion, I would describe how much I hated going to church, or how boring or annoying it was. But at the same time, I was also discovering science. I remember there was this class where the nun put a teapot full of water on a burner. And as it heated up, it started to steam. And she said, "Do you see this steam right here? This is molecules." Now, I have to give it to this nun. Teaching molecules to first graders is like a massive concept. But she got us so excited by an understanding of the natural world, right? Science can understand at the exact temperature that ice can turn to water and water can turn to steam. And that there are these things so small the human eye can't even see, but they are the building blocks of everything around us. And that's how well we know the natural world. And then over here, they're teaching us about the Bible, and there's literally like people in whales and floods that take out everyone. And my brain just kind of intuitively was being pulled toward science and hyper-questioning religion. And I think my insistence with my parents or their own issues with that school that I will someday find out about led to me luckily going to the public school the next year.
Did you have a conversation with your parents? Like, I want to leave?
Yes, I definitely had a conversation about hating the school as a first grader. And then also just hating church in general. Like, we still would go to church on Sunday, even though you're going to church every day at that school. And never enjoying the ritual, not enjoying the beliefs, even though I probably didn't fully wrap my head around it. Eventually, my mom did something that I think a lot of parents do. I think it was fourth or fifth grade. She said, if you finish First Communion, I'll let you decide if you ever want to go to church again. And so I said, sign me up, let's do it. And I did it. I was that annoying brat during all the CCD classes, complaining about why all these stories are silly. And then at the end, I get dressed up in the robes. I'm the tallest one because I did it a year later. I'm holding the giant cross. We walk down. I get the communion wafer in my mouth. And that was the last time I went to church until I was in college.
So going from this like religious school into public school, how do you develop that sense of identity to when you would eventually find like the word atheist? And like, how do you find that word?
That is a fun story. I was in sixth grade when I discovered the word atheist, and I found it flipping through a dictionary. I think we had an open reading class, some type of, you know, English or language class. I forget what they call them back in sixth grade. And normally everybody just picks a spot on the floor and you go read whatever book they tell you. But whether I was a brat or a contrarian or whatever, I just decided I want to do my own thing. And so for fun, I used to flip through the dictionary and try to come up with words that would make my friends laugh. I don't know. It was just this silly thing I'd do. And there's this giant, big red dictionary in the back of the room. And I was flipping through the A's, and it happened to be in this dictionary at the very top right corner. There was this word, atheist. And I read it, and it said a disbelief in God or gods, which I now have much better definitions. But what was so exciting is I just had this massive existential moment. I said, that's me. I have a word. You know, when you leave religion young, people don't tell you there's other religions. I didn't know the difference between Catholic or Christian. I didn't know there were Buddhists and Zoroastrians. I had no idea there's this whole world of religion. And then suddenly there's a word for people who don't believe in God or who question belief in God. And I started to use that word. I started to go up to my friends. I'm an atheist. I started to talk to my mom. Hey, I found this word, atheist. And then I discovered very quickly, people don't like that word.
What was the reception when you hear that word or when they heard that word?
I think this is a different experience. If I was in the South, this would have been different. If I was in Saudi Arabia, this obviously would be different. But I mostly had accepting parents and accepting friends. I think part of this was growing up in a highly educated town in Massachusetts with a very kind of liberal population. I learned it's a word that is very controversial in our society. And I don't think I fully understood that until I was older. But yeah, it definitely just wasn't ever an inviting word. Yeah. The way walking up to most people in America and saying, yeah, I'm Christian, I go to church, probably is perceived.
Do you think there was like when you started identifying with that word, was there any isolation that came with that? Or was it more of like a solidifying of identity and maybe drawing community near?
So a lot of people, when they leave religion, they lose a community. And the process for leaving religion is a very lonely and individualistic one, where it's usually the opposite when people talk about finding religion. The path to religion is finding a community usually. For me, whether it be because I grew up in a kind of individualist household and my parents let us be very independent and kind of encouraged that, or just the town I grew up in where freedom was so valued, I had no issues. It was mostly an empowering experience and there wasn't much backlash.
Yeah, probably because of, again, that like liberal yeah. area that you were
yeah.
in.
And you know, this could be a critique of my parents or a highlight of my parents, but they really wanted us to be our own people and they really allowed that. There was always this freedom to kind of do things on your own and have your own identity that, yeah, I have to thank them for now looking at it.
So how did that identity evolve like going into high school and like looking towards college?
I had a California identity. So my dad was born in San Diego. And when you grew up in Massachusetts and you leave in December for like winter break and fly out to San Diego and it's sunny and there's palm trees, you just decide this is paradise. I need to live here someday. And then I guess I'm seventh generation Californian. So my whole life, my parents have told me like, you got to live in California. You're a Californian. If you have kids, you got to go to California to have kids. And so since probably around the same time I was discovered the identity of atheist, I had this hyper identity of kind of California as this dream spot I need to live and that I'm a Californian. So when college search time came along and my parents had the ability for me to look at private schools, I only looked in California. I looked at Southern California, small schools, maybe I could play tennis at. So religion really wasn't on my radar until some of the top schools that started popping up were religious that fit that demographic. So Pepperdine, California Lutheran University, Concordia, University of San Diego, like these all have connections to churches or have long histories with religion or are pretty explicitly religious, whether they teach it in class or require some type of religious participation. And so I think a junior year, is that when you search? We took a flight out, we visited about 10 different schools, and I, knowing my beliefs around religion were so strong, said, let's start with California Lutheran University, because obviously I'm not Lutheran. That sounds the most religious. I'm going to hate that. Let's do that one first, just so we like learn how to do tours. And I had this beautiful experience. With the tour guide, we're walking through campus, you're going through the sports facilities, everything's new. It's a very young university. And it ends in the chapel. You walk into this beautiful, tall stone building with stained glass windows, and you're sitting in the pews talking to the tour guide. And I'm like, this is my opportunity. How religious is this school? Tell me on a scale of 1 to 10, like, come on, don't lie to me. You're a student. Tell me how bad this place is. And I'm like, I'm an atheist. Like, could I possibly be comfortable here? And she gives this beautiful answer, which was, it is as religious as you want to make it, or it is as secular as you want to make it. So we have a Lutheran tradition at the school, but we don't require any religion at the school, which is not, you know, not all schools are like that. There's a lot of private schools that do. Then in San Diego, at the end of the trip, we'd seen all 8 or 10 schools. And I just kept thinking about that little school in Thousand Oaks. I was like, oh God, let's go back. So I had my parents drive all the way back up to Thousand Oaks. And I did another tour of campus and I just fell in love with this little school. And so as a shock to everyone I knew in high school, I applied early, got in early, got a scholarship, and didn't apply anywhere else, to California Lutheran University.
What was it actually like? Was that true? And did you like want to get involved?
Yeah, for the most part, very true. I mean, yes, when they open orientation, there is a prayer. Are there paid pastors? Absolutely. And is there a church that hosts events every now and then? Absolutely. Like the biggest venue, if you want to host a speaker on campus, is the chapel. But for me and a lot of my friends, yeah, there was no pressure. We could be as secular as we wanted. I remember my freshman year, I got involved with the Gay Straight Alliance on campus, and we were mobilizing because this was 2007, 2008, which anyone remembers the world in that moment. You had Obama running for president against McCain, and in California, we had Proposition 8 as the massive political issue. So gay marriage had been passed at the state legislature. We became one of the first states in America to allow gay marriage. And then there was this ballot initiative that would have stripped that right. It would have been one of the only times in American history where we pulled back on a right that we expanded to a group of people. So my friends and I, we were on the streets in Thousand Oaks, California, which is not known for being a liberal bastion. And every day you're out there and there's cars going by and we're holding signs and some are giving thumbs up and so excited. And then the others are shouting obscenities at you and you're getting this really disgusting hate speech. And we'd always kind of have a recovery meeting after an hour or two of protesting. And so finally, after one of those protests, we all were hanging out in some conference room and everyone was just so upset about the things we were hearing from some of the people driving by or the counter protesters. And I finally just asked anyone, Are any of you even religious? I mean, we hear all this religious messaging and hate, and it seems to be causing trauma. Is anyone here even religious? And one by one, everyone went around and gave unique answers, but mostly secular. You know, I'm questioning, or I grew up Lutheran. I'm not really sure what I am. My roommate doesn't know that I'm questioning. My parents definitely don't know. And I'm here on a scholarship from my church. You know, another person's comfortable calling themselves an atheist. Another person's like, no, I'm still Christian, but I'm still figuring things out. And in that moment, I asked everyone, would there be value in an atheist club on campus? And that's what took everything to another level. Is by the end of that year, I had founded the first atheist club at Cal Lutheran and suddenly became the most public atheist on campus immediately.
Was there any backlash about that?
there was hesitation, but there was a few things that really helped as well. So I had already joined student government at that point, and I was already starting to get involved in a lot of things. So when I filled out the paperwork to start a club, I was more prepped than 95% of people who show up with a new club proposal. I knew the process for how it would go. I knew the counter arguments, and I had support built before we did that. And while we got a lot of questions, there definitely was a lot of concern, it was really great that we could kind of prove it with our actions. Like, we had the trust of enough people, and the university wasn't so close-minded that they would stop us. And within the first year or two, they started bragging about us. We became this really exciting thing on campus. I became a tour guide my second year, and I, you know, like everyone else, would do the tours, and I always would use the same line that the tour guide used for me when we're sitting in the chapel. And then I heard that all the other tour guides were using my club as an example of diversity on campus, because they were getting so many questions about religion from a growing, you know, secular applicant pool of young people. And so, oh yeah, we have all religions here. We have a secular club. You know, you could be whatever you want here. And our club was unique. We explored religion weirdly. We did all these interfaith adventures. I went to pagan rituals and mosques and synagogues.
What was the reason for that?
I think we responded to the fact that we were on a religious campus. So we couldn't just publicly talk about our atheism and challenge religion without knowing why. We already chose to go to Cal Lutheran. We knew we had put ourselves in a religious environment, and so we might as well get to know what everyone believes.
And I think to effectively challenge something, you actually have to investigate it.
Yeah. And I think strategically, I don't even think we were consciously thinking about this, but showing compassion and understanding for other people's beliefs it opens a door. You can have conversations that you wouldn't be able to have otherwise. So while you have to study religion historically going to Cal Lutheran, it's part of the core curriculum, we would have religious studies students join our club. I have this woman who's now a Lutheran pastor who used to be an active member in our club, because we talked about religion more than some of her classes, and we actively engaged it in experiential manner. So,
because in a way, like, that group can play devil's advocate better than anyone else if you actually are trying to strengthen any kind of like religious faith or doctrine.
We found a lot of partners using that exact argument. We found the religions that were willing to question themselves so that they understood what they believed, so that they could believe it harder, loved working with us. They would go on some of the adventures. You know, we had like a Lutheran club that went to a Black Baptist church with us one time. And, you know, for them, it was really exciting to see the differences in the types of Christianities.
What was one of the religious services that you attended that had like the most profound impact on how you viewed religion as a whole?
It was actually the Black Baptist Church experience in Simi Valley. We had gone there with the Lutheran club, and actually one of the pastors on our campus kind of led it. She knew one of the leaders of that church. And so we went with another group of students, and after the hour and a half of singing and dancing, the pastor does his big sermon. That's like another like 30, 45 minutes. And then they'd do this thing where he asked for prayers from the congregants. And so people would come up and they'd say, hey, I am struggling to get into this college, and I just really want God's help to get into school. Will God help me? And he'd go, yes, God will answer your prayers. He'll help you get into a school. And it just kept getting more intense. So the next story, it was this couple in their 20s or 30s. And they said, We've been trying to have a kid. We've just been trying for years, and we just haven't been able to have a kid yet. And we really want to have a kid. Will God help us have a kid? And he gets up close, kind of embraces them and says, yes, God will help you. You keep your faith in God, you will have a child. And while that's annoying and unscientific, I just kind of was like, okay, you know, if that helps them feel better about this process, that'll be great. But the thing that really shook me was the next one. There was this older woman, very short. She walks up slowly. She gets to the front and she turns around and talks to everyone and says, my son has leukemia. And we don't know how old this son is. I'm guessing a teen. And she said, you know, has had leukemia for years. The first time it got really bad, the doctors step in, they saved his life. But I don't trust the doctors anymore. And his leukemia is getting really bad again. And I just want to know if God will cure my son or not. And there's this silence, right? He comes up, he puts his hand on his shoulder, kind of looks out to all of us, and he said, "Don't you worry about anything. You don't need those doctors. God will help your son." And I'm looking around. I'm looking left, I'm looking right, and most people are really into it. They're like bowing their head, they're raising their arms. And I feel like I'm the loneliest person in the world going like, that could kill him. If ignoring the doctors, right? Ignoring the needs of your son, if he's under 18 and he doesn't have enough autonomy to get to a hospital, like your religious belief here, this guy telling you to ignore modern medicine could literally kill someone. So that was intense. That kind of reinvigorated me to think about my work, not just as supporting atheists, which there's endless amount of work to be done there. These are millions of people who don't have communities often, but also challenging religious privilege and its legitimacy sometimes, because people are hurting other people off of this perceived legitimacy of ancient belief that I think should never go unchallenged.
Especially when it could endanger someone's life.
Yeah. And children. Every single year in America, there are children who die because a parent gets in their head that God is speaking to them and that I don't need to give my kid medicine, or I don't need to give them food, or I have the right to kill them. In my mind, goes mad, but religion is the justification behind that. And when it gets to those extremes, we go, oh yeah, okay, like of course that's wrong. But what about all the harms that led up to that? What about denying them access to religion, right? There are religions that won't let you get your child get a blood transfusion if they are in a car accident. There are religions that will deny you access to therapy or gender affirming care if you're dealing with those issues. So I don't know. Religion's legitimacy is assumed. This is called theist normativity in our society. And just by being an atheist and being open about it, I get to be one of the first steps in us challenging that legitimacy and asking, are there better ways to answer these questions?
So when you had that experience, how did you start to enact a, like more change?
I got involved more. So I remember we came back after that meeting like we would always do, and we would talk about it. So usually we'd go to something Sunday morning, and then Sunday night would be our meetings, and we'd go, what was your experience? What was that like? What did you learn? And for me, that was one of our most intense meetings, because it was no longer this hypothetical about religion. It's not like, we're just discussing all these ideas and history books. We're going, people's lives are in danger if we aren't publicly fighting for science, if we aren't proud atheists that can challenge the legitimacy of some of these things sometimes. So if we aren't working with other religious allies on, you know, more progressive ideas for the world. So I ran for student body president, actually. I became the first openly atheist student body president at Cal Lutheran, which was fun. I didn't really get much pushback during the process, but I did hear there were a lot of alumni that were not excited about that. And after college, I joined the board of the Secular Student Alliance, that kind of the national org that I was affiliated with, which started to send me to national conferences and meetings and lobby days. Suddenly I could be, as an adult, a secular activist. And that led me to founding the Humanist Community of Ventura County, building community and doing advocacy for separation of church and state and for humanist and atheist community building, which is thrilling, is challenging, right? There aren't that many people in the world doing it, so we're figuring it out as we go.
I'm curious, post-college, when you got more involved in like political campaigns, I'm curious how you applied the lessons that you learned in the school setting advocacy to like the James Wood for Congress campaign.
Yeah. I think I had a dream when I was a kid that I would like be an entrepreneur or work in politics or, you know, do something really exciting with nonprofits. And the beauty is I just started trying to do all of them. And that became my focus. So starting a nonprofit after school was exciting. And then a friend called me. She says, "Hey, I got this friend. He's 35. He used to have all these medical issues. He's legally blind, and he wants to run for Congress as an open atheist in the most conservative district in Arizona. You want to join the team?" And I just was like, I have no idea. But yeah, I thought about it for a day or two. I came out to Arizona. I met him, got to talk to him for a bit. And what sold me wasn't that it was a traditional political campaign and I was going to learn the political process. It was, we're going to run a publicity stunt campaign and bring attention to secular issues in politics. We have this opportunity because he's a Democrat in a super red district. He has no shot in winning, right? We've looked at all the stats. Like, there is no world in which he wins this race. So let's not pretend we're going to win the race. Let's think about how we can get messaging out on the issues we want that will inspire future candidates and future issue advocacy in the region to make progress. And so, yeah, I moved to Arizona as this wide-eyed 25-year-old, no idea how to do anything in politics. And we came up with one of, I think, the most interesting, media-worthy, kind of sassy campaign on a shoestring budget.
What were some of the things you did?
Let's see, this is 2014, and we started off the campaign by doing an atheist media day. No candidate that we'd heard of in American history had ever done an atheist media day. So we invited a bunch of bloggers, we called up a bunch of press outlets, and we said, like, our candidate's going to be available to talk about religion and politics. He is an open atheist, and he, as far as we can tell, he's the only one running for federal office this year. And yeah, suddenly, like, HuffPo called, and we had a video interview, and every secular blogger in America was writing about it and publishing our press release. So we had this really cool kind of, you know, jumpstart of him as a secular and humanist candidate. And then the second one was our biggest stunt. We really wanted to speak about the issue of guns and abortion. And we couldn't quite figure out how to speak about those two issues, right? And we kept getting these letters in the mail. We're talking these little postcard style letters, and they were pre-written, and then somebody would sign their name and they would say, 53 million unborn babies have died since Roe v. Wade. What are you going to do to overturn Roe v. Wade? And every week we'd get a few of these. We had this campaign house. There were three of us living in it. We were running the campaign from it. And it just kept coming. You know, like, we thought, okay, a week or two, this is a fluke, right? Some advocacy group. And then we just kept getting them to the point where we had 20 or 30 of these. And we were kind of pissed off. We were getting really pissed, right? Most politicians probably just ignore that. But we were going, you know, I bet nobody's ever replied to these assholes. There's such an opportunity here to speak to our values. And so we wrote this stock letter on letterhead that was like, if you really want to stop abortion, here's all the scientifically proven ways to do it, right? You're going to want access to contraceptives. You're going to want free condoms everywhere. You're going to want actually accessible abortions, because that actually lowers the amount of abortions. Here's this list of scientifically proven things that actually lower abortion that you hate all of those. We already know that they are against all of those, but we're going to put it in this kind of tongue-in-cheek letter and put them on the defense a little. And so we've got this letter. We sit on it for about a week because we just go like, but then what? They're going to get a letter and they're going to throw it in the trash and we're all just going to move on with our lives. What else could we do? Is there something we could do to make this exciting? And I forget who came up with it, but we said, what if we threw a condom in the letter? What if we literally got our own condoms and put our logo on it and wrote something silly like prevent abortion on the condom and then mail those with the letters? And we just ran with it. We just, within 24 hours, we had ordered the custom condom box of like 300 condoms. They showed up, we sent out the letters, we put out a press release, and by the next day, we were on every feminist blog in the country. We were raising tens of thousands of dollars. We were getting, you know, love and hate from the local party. It's the probably, you know, second most viral thing I've done as a political consultant in my whole life. And it was hilarious. I mean, the campaign the year before had raised, I think, only $30,000 running as a Democrat, and we raised like $30,000 off just that stunt. And then we also did a stunt with guns. We took our blind candidate to a gun show, exploited the gun show loophole, bought the gun, went home, made a like 1 minute video close up on his face while he plays with the gun, and then it ends where he gets up, unfurls his campaign, and walks away. And you realize the guy that was just talking to you was blind. Beautiful. We made the nightly news that night.
Wow,
it was a blast.
It seems like the advocacy transcended past college and was like brought into the political world.
And there's creative ways to engage it from a, you know, sticking to your values as well. I think so many people tell you when you get involved in politics, you're going to have to sell your soul. You're going to have to compromise all over the place. And we did the opposite. We came up with the most creative ways to fully express our values. You know, we ran, I think, the most humanist campaign that's been run in American history. By being ourselves. And yes, we had the freedom of knowing we weren't going to win the campaign, but it inspired me to look for creative solutions to how to do the crazy radical things you want to do rather than feeling like you always have to compromise your values. Does it mean you're going to get paid a lot less sometimes? Yes. Does it mean you're going to have to work harder than anyone who's ever worked? Yes. Are you going to be treated like this long shot all the time? 100%. You know, my parents, I remember my dad kept going, you know, when you're done fucking around, I'd love to help you find a job, right? Like I had sticks in my head so hard because, you know, he said that for 10 years, yeah. You know, I never stopped doing it. I found that if you can be creative enough, there are actual ways to raise money and build a social movement or build community or build an organization.
Right? It's hard. Like the road to do something that is like completely value aligned means that you can't compromise. And when you can't compromise, it's just, you have to do it the hard way.
And we shouldn't ignore the amount of privilege that's needed to pull this off, right? Yeah. If I didn't have the safety net of parents I could live with, I don't know that I could have done this. And most people don't, right? If your parents are poor or sick or don't exist anymore, you can't risk your income and life, your food and shelter on, yeah. You know, doing these crazy things. So,
especially because America is not a place that really has a safety net.
Exactly. I mean, this is why most entrepreneurs have rich parents, right? And are white men for the most part, right? Like it's the group taking the least risk often to take a risk. With that said, I still think we need to encourage more people to take the risk. There's so much to be done if somebody is willing to sacrifice their time, their income, their, you know, for these larger ideas that move society forward. You know, I think the religious right has done this to such an extent where we take serious ideas like not allowing abortion access for the entire country, even though one religion doesn't want that for their people. You know, these things aren't challenged unless we do some radical things and organize and inspire generations of people to think about these on timelines larger than just next year.
So how did you come back to being an advocate for atheism?
Well, what's lucky is the next year we became known as the people who ran atheists for political office. And we worked with, I think, 12 secular candidates the next year.
Wow.
Arizona became this hotbed for secular politics. We became the only political firm in the country that specialized in running atheists for office. We didn't plan to do that, but it was thrilling. And then after doing that for a few years, traveled the country with a podcast for a while, trying to promote humanism and talk about these issues, trying some public speaking, I had this unbelievable opportunity come up. This community in Los Angeles, this 40-year-old community called Atheists United, they have this, you know, old Victorian mansion that they host a lot of their events in Echo Park. And they have this long, rich history of kind of being one of the biggest and best organizers of secular community in the country. Somebody died and gave them $500,000, and they were looking for their first full-time staffer. They were looking for someone to become the professional atheist to lead their community, which there are almost none of. In American history, we have had a handful of people who have ever been paid to run an atheist community, which is very different than being a lawyer working on separation of church and state, or a lobbyist that goes to DC and fights for millions of atheists. This is trying to figure out what essentially a religious institution would look like for a non-religious crowd. And I am so lucky I became their kind of top candidate, if not only candidate, and snuck right in there and became the first executive director of Atheists United. And I got to tell my mom I got a job. Atheists United.
So what was Atheists United at that point? And what did you want to change it into? And what did you think you could do with it?
Atheists United looked like a lot of progressive religious communities in that it was old, it was white, and it was struggling to figure out how to exist in 2019. You know, we have the rise of social media. You have You know, we're in the biggest communications change in American history with all these new ways to communicate. We have all this technology, and yet young people aren't joining anything. I mean, to some extent, we're seeing religious institutions are seeing this massive drop off in participation of young people, and even atheist organizations that thrived in the early 2000s, the late 90s, where people were first finding each other, you know, the rise of the internet, and suddenly, oh, we can find each other, we exist. And they start building these local communities, and they go through their first leadership splits and kind of like figure out the political landscape. And then you come 2010, 2015, and you're just starting to see this kind of, hey, why aren't 20-somethings joining these communities? Even 30-somethings aren't joining these communities.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's a handful of factors, but most of these communities, they wind up being run by retired white people who like are really excited about a speaker who can host really good discussion meetings, but aren't doing anything that actually addresses the needs maybe of a 20-something. And the needs of a 20-something in 2020 is so different than a 1980s 20-something. You know, our economy is so different. The amount of jobs we work, the amount of student loan debt that exists. I just think organizing is so different. And we didn't have a lot of leaders who have figured out what that might look like nowadays, who are talking to young people and spend time with young people and are thinking about what excites them, what draws them in, and not just what will get them to show up, which is a huge question I think any organizer asks. Okay, how do I get you to even pay attention to me? Any marketer has the same question. But I think when you're building a community, you need to know why are they going to stay, right? There's getting attention, there's building belonging, but then there's this second part, which is helping you grow as a human being, helping you develop and expand upon yourself, having the need for community to be something larger than just, that's where my people go. Having it be a place that you like want to raise your kids or you can count on in a time of crisis, which I think, you know, the best of religion does. Yeah. I'm actually jealous of that as a non-theist who, when I think about my community needs, sometimes don't have places that I can do community service and know I'm going to be around other people who aren't going to push religion on me. Or if I'm sick, people that are going to visit me in the hospital, right? Like there are religious traditions who've gotten really good at that. And I think that is incredible. I want more of that in society. And non-theists right now, if you leave religion, if there isn't an active group in your society, and if that group isn't well organized, what are you going to do? Where are you going to do your community service? Where are you going to raise your kids? Where they're going to teach your values? And where are they going to help you come up with the language for your beliefs? Where are they going to help you look for existential wonder without God or gods involved in the conversation? And that's the opportunity of what we're doing. You know, we have millions and millions and millions of non-theists across the United States, and they don't have, I think, safe, inclusive, and growth-minded communities where they can develop as human beings. And so if we do our job right, I don't just give you a place to be an atheist. I help improve your life and you have a lifelong community.
And I think that looks like really just like friendship and hanging out.
At its base level, there's actually tons of research. If you look at the research on religious people versus non-theist people, it shows that religious people live longer, report higher levels of happiness, donate more to charity, volunteer more, and I forget the fifth, but there's all these social benefits of participating in religion. But if you look at the study, it actually has nothing to do with intensity of belief. It's all how often you go to your synagogue or mosque or temple, right? The more you are pro-social and participate in community, you reap all of the pro-social benefits. And we have dozens of years of research now that shows just being around other people helps with depression, gets you involved more, reports like you literally become more politically active just by being in the room with other people. So I joke that, yeah, I have all these huge, massive existential things I want to work on as an atheist organizer. I want to get us organized and I want to fight all these issues. But at the end of the day, like if all I did was get people together for like bowling parties and hanging out, I literally improved your life and I improved society around you. Like I think because we live in America and we all have to move around in cars sometimes, we've ripped out these third places, we forget the value inherent in just gathering with other people, especially people you feel safe around and that are like-minded. And so that's the first and foremost thing we have to do with an atheist community, right? Like atheism doesn't beg community. Like there's nothing about atheism that says I need a community for it, right? Like picture finding a community of other people who don't collect stamps. Like that would be weird, right? But in America, our identity is politicized, right? Being an atheist is not something where you will be treated on an equal footing. We have literal laws in some states that are designed to attack us. We have countries where I can be put to death legally because I just said I am an atheist. If I were to go to Bangladesh or Saudi Arabia today, they literally can just throw me in jail, imprison me for life, or execute me for questioning the religion of the government. So in that case, we have political reasons we have to gather for, but we also will have all the communal needs of any other group. And by providing those, you know, whether we call it atheist or not in the future doesn't really matter to me. But right now it's important that you're around other atheists because it's not safe to be in some places and to talk about these ideas. And politically, you are not an equal.
So what is Atheists United up to today? And what are you most excited about?
Atheists United is what I would call a thriving secular community. We have hundreds of members that exist. I just looked it up yesterday, actually, in 13 states, which we're designed for California. We're actually like a local group for Southern California, but we have people from across the United States who just love our work and want to support it. And we do everything from support groups. We have a recovering from religion support group for people who grew up maybe with religious trauma, whether it was your sexuality or you got a divorce or just beliefs about the world. If you have traumatic experiences from that, you need to talk to other non-theists about that trauma. You need to process that trauma. And there's no religious person that can help you with religious trauma. So we create a safe space for that. We also have a secular recovery program, which is like AA, but without any concepts of higher power and is much more science focused, where AA hasn't really updated in 100 years. We have programs like our youth group that supports young people. We have a hiking group. We have all these subgroups where people with specific hobbies or affinities can get together.
Is there something that you've noticed moves the needle in terms of like community engagement?
I think the biggest thing I'm noticing is actually volunteer work. So when our community promotes our programs, people get excited by our parties. They get excited by our hikes or, you know, our little gatherings we do, maybe a speaker event. But when we say we host a food distribution once a month and we're going to hand out 3,000 pounds of food and we don't really care who you are or why you're here, come help us. I have brought in more people to the community through that work than any other program I can think of. I think in today's world, I don't think we start conversations as much, especially in Los Angeles. Again, if we were in Mississippi, this might be different. But in Los Angeles, you don't start conversations with, here's what religion I am, here's what church I go to, here's, you know, how I identify and on the spectrum of communities. I think you want to communicate through your actions and you want to tell people on Instagram. You know, I want to say, hey, I volunteer. I worked with the food bank this week and I helped people who were hungry get food. Like that's, I think, mostly how we want to express ourselves. So our food distribution has been really cool. It is the most age diverse program we have. It brings in everybody. And what's nice is you never have to talk about religion in that space. If you want to, if you have religious trauma and you know you're around other atheists, you can engage that topic. But we're not there for that topic. We're there to help the community. And we happen to be doing this as atheists because sometimes there aren't secular places for us to do this work.
Has there ever been moments that have like challenged your atheism?
Not for me. You know, what's funny is how boring the question of atheism has become for me. This is probably just because of I'm such a public atheist and I settled this question so long ago and I have such confidence in it. I just don't even think about it that often. I think what's more interesting is people always want to discuss atheism with me. And I always go, no, I don't really want to talk about God. I just, you know, I settled that question years ago. I want to talk about atheists. There are these human beings who decided atheism is their belief and have to figure out how to navigate society now, right? And that's that identity is politicized and the progress and issues they're going to deal with is, I think, more of a political question and a social question. How do you raise kids as an atheist? Like, that's a super deep question that does not have an easy answer, like yes or no, like God exists. That's a yes or no type of thing if you're like pushing for conclusions for most people. Where, how do you raise your kids? There's no yes or no. There's just a little bit of gray over here, and here's some research over here, and here's what we're trying. Like, we're going to be working on that question 2,000 years from now. And that's what gets me up and excited about these days. And I've honestly found the religious partners I work best with are at the same place. So it's not this idea that we have to fight over theism and atheism often comes from what I would call insecure religion, right? Theistic supremacist groups who say you have to believe what I believe or else, or the only option and anything other than our option is bad. Well, that's not how the world exists. We know there's millions of people who have different beliefs and we all still have to like fund schools and send our kids to them and build businesses and feed each other. Like we live in an ecosystem. You can't just be a supremacist and walk away. So while I encourage everyone to have those deep existential interpersonal questions, I want to also encourage people to ask the political questions because I think you'll get a lot more runway on trying to ask about human rights and about dignity and how to lower suffering and then look at it from the unique angle of a Christian perspective or a Jewish perspective or a completely secular scientific perspective.
So do you think when people come to your community, do you feel like they come with a developed and matured idea of like their belief systems? And so it's not necessarily about a deepening of any type of like framework. It's more of a, where are people that share this framework and how can I build community?
Yeah. Think about an LGBT center, right? When they capture people who first join an LGBT center or a group at an LGBT center, they're not teaching you how to be queer, right? They're not, you know, they might have some programs that help you as you're maybe transitioning into identities or transitioning gender, for instance. Like they have support programs in place to help you find language, find community, think through these things or deprogram the things you were taught. So to some extent, we have a program like that in recovering from religion, but mostly it's a place where you can organize parties, have a senior group that plays bingo, have a youth group where you know you will never have to deal with, you know, Christian ideas around gender. So I think you can organize communities around a personal identity more than a philosophical identity.
What would you say the difference is between those two?
The theism of Christianity is different than Christians, basically. So if we're going to have a philosophical debate about whether God exists, we're having a conversation about theism versus atheism. And I can have that with any religion in the world, right? They're all different types of theism. So if somebody believes in Thor, I can have that conversation with them. And while that's really cool, ultimately you're trying to come to an answer of whether God exists or not, whether Thor exists or not, and to what extent they exist, right? Maybe I'm an agnostic and fall somewhere in the middle on that. Maybe you're all agnostic unicornists, like I think we all should be.
What's an agnostic unicornist?
I wrote a paper back in college that was about the difference between agnostic and atheist, and basically how technically we're all agnostic about everything because we can't disprove anything to 100%, yeah. Right? This is always the critique of atheists. Well, how can you call yourself an atheist because you can't disprove there's a God? Well, I'm like, well, we don't disprove most things, but when we don't believe in them, we don't use, you know, this softer language for it. I don't, you know, if I ask people if they believe in unicorns, most people just go, no. And I go, oh, so are you agnostic about unicorns? And like, no. And I'm like, but technically you can't disprove it. And they're like, well, philosophically I can't. I'm like, okay, so you're an agnostic unicornist. but yeah, so if you're having debate around agnosticism and atheism and theism, I think then the theist question is the most important thing. And there are atheist communities who have been organized around that. They are discussion groups or they're counter apologetics groups. So apologetics are this group of Christians who try to use like scientific language and philosophy to try to convince us that they have the most true answer. And then there's this whole group of atheists who have come up with all these counter arguments and they go into these debates forever. And again, that's important for people, but you're right. I think most people who need community, who need the place to raise your kids, place to do community service, place where you know you can have people that count on you, that's not a theistic question. That's not a theistic need that you're trying to address.
And I think most of the needs are not necessarily theistic. They're like
human.
They're human needs. Yeah.
And what's just interesting is we just happen to be going at them from a non-theistic perspective. The biggest question I think you can ask someone who organizes me is, why do we need an atheist community? Like, why would you ever need a community surrounded around a concept around what you don't believe? I'm like, you don't. right? Norway is not building a bunch of atheist communities right now. Like, they have a mostly secular population, and community is a neighborhood block. Community is democracy. Community is the soccer team or the chess club you're involved in. So why would you create an atheist community? Aren't you just organizing around atheism? And this is why I always have to separate the two. You know, atheism is a question we all answered that shouldn't matter, that should be boring, and we should be all treated like the people in Norway building soccer teams. But in America, it's political. You know, answering that question and calling yourself publicly an atheist and then trying to run for office, we know is not something that's normal. You know, trying to fight religious privilege in our society and say all people should be treated equally, even if you lack a belief in God, that's weirdly controversial in our society. So until that's fixed, until we can guarantee human rights and equality and the removal of privilege for all people in society, regardless of your identity, regardless of your belief, then we have to create safe places for these people, and we have to build separate environments where they can do their own organizing, right? Like, the government has decided it's not going to fix homelessness, it's not going to fix hunger. And so who steps up to do that in our society? It has to be nonprofits, and historically that's always been religion. Who has the money and organizing capacity to fight homelessness, to help refugees, to give aid to other countries when something bad happens? And the problem with that is it gets abused sometimes, right? That secular people aren't welcome in that work. Some of the aid is only given to people of specific religious traditions. And so until the government uses democracy and pluralism to fix that and make it welcoming to everyone, we kind of have to get involved and have our own idea and programs for what this could look like.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, DM us at Finding Founders Podcast on Instagram, LinkedIn, or Facebook. Finding Founders is produced and hosted by me, Samuel Donner.
Our audio editing team lead is Ashley Jimenez, with support from
Jessica Morales,
Miley Lipton, Siyu
Pan, Kenny Ray,
Josie Yo,
Matt Fernandez,
and Merritt Hill.
Our outreach and research team lead is Desiree Nunez, with support from
Marissa Granados,
Monica Lee,
Sarah Tiersma,
and Yao Liu.
To see more of what we're up to, subscribe to our newsletter at findingfounders.co. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week.